If they can show.
Good morning, everyone. We're going to get started. I'll call the Senate Committee on Judiciary to order.
There you go.
I'm going to deviate a little bit from the public hearing and possible work session agenda as to the scheduling of bills. Representative Cameron's here, so I'd like to take that bill first. So we'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 2685.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2685 comes here from the Marin County Sheriff, Jason Meyer, and clarifies that an offender transferred from the Department of Corrections facility to a local jail is eligible for the same form of temporary transitional leave that the offender would be eligible in the Department of Corrections institution.
All right, thank you.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, State Representative Kevin Cameron represent House District 19, South and East Salem, Almsville, Turner. I also serve on the Governor's Reentry Council, have for several years, and here in Marion County on the Marion County Reentry Council. House Bill 2685 is about reentry and some of the great things that are being done right here locally in Marion County. I'm going to let the experts give you the details, but one of the things I want to make the members of the committee aware of that we have a program going on currently that has a recidivism rate of 27, I believe it's 27%, maybe it's down to 24% here in Marion County. And if you could apply that across the state to reduce recidivism rate, we would be saving millions and millions and millions of dollars in the state on people who are going back into prison after they've already been there. So I would encourage your support, and I'll be happy to answer any questions that I may be able to, but there's experts here who are better equipped to do that. So thank you for hearing this bill today.
Thank you. Representative, did you want to stay for the rest of the presentation, or do you need to go on?
I think I'll just sit and listen.
Okay.
Yeah, that'd be great.
All right. So Jeff Kemp, who wants to go first?
All right. I assume that's me. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Wood. I serve as the Parole and Probation Division Commander with the Marion County Sheriff's Office. I am here, although I do not look like him. I am representing Sheriff Jason Myers for this hearing, and as well as the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors, and we are in support of House Bill 2685. As you're all well aware, 2685 authorizes the Department of Corrections to contract with political subdivisions within the state and allow for temporary release of inmates conveyed to another jurisdiction on the same terms and conditions as they are when confined in the Department of Corrections. To give you some color and context about this bill and the necessity of it, during the 2011 legislative session, there was a legislative budget note that attached $1 million for reentry service projects, pilots, and although there was a period of significant delays, what had occurred was, in consultation with the Department of Corrections and going through this process, was that the Department of Corrections, for lack of a better word, I don't mean to take Kim's thunder, but didn't have the legislature or the statutory authority to engage in this process, and House Bill 2685 fixes that. Locally in Marion County, as Representative Cameron had mentioned, we get about 600 individuals who are released from the State Department of Corrections each year. Through our local Marion County Reentry Initiative, we've achieved a significant degree of success in reducing our recidivism rate by almost half. Over the years, we have observed in terms of successful transition and reentry, those hinge on front-loading of services for people returning to our community. Over the years, we've developed a number of evidence-based cognitive employment practices, housing, treatment, and what we have seen, or one of the keys that we've seen over the years, and this is embarrassingly simple, direct face-to-face contact and connecting people to community resources and explaining to them what the process will be has amazing benefits to us. Historically, we've had a no-show rate for people being released from the institutions to our community. We had a no-show rate of about 30%. That has dropped to less than 3%. And what we hope from this pilot project, what we hope to do is to transition people from the Department of Corrections, designated people from the Department of Corrections Institution to our Marion County Work Center so that, one, we can have that face-to-face contact, and, two, we can provide an array of services that addresses those key criminogenic needs, those key risk factors that we know are linked to future criminal activity. And so, you know, as the state looks to pilot innovative ways to lower recidivism at a lower cost while also maintain the highest degree of public safety, we believe that House Bill 2685 will act in furtherance of these goals.
Thank you. Kim?
Good morning. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, I'm Kim Brokamp. I'm the new Assistant Director of Offender Management and Rehabilitation at the Oregon Department of Corrections. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2685 and answer any questions you have. As you've heard, House Bill 2685 removes the restrictive language that our legislative council, or excuse me, our agency council recognized when we were trying to contract with community corrections to quarter house these inmates in these reentry pilot projects. A budget note in 2011 gave us the ability to enter into the agreements, and as I said, during the development of those agreements, we recognized we had a statutory problem. House Bill 2685 has an emergency clause that will allow both the implementation of these projects and allow the budget note to move forward. We look forward to collaborating with different community corrections agencies. Currently, we have a contract with Marion County. We have two other agencies we're working with, potentially a fourth one. We look forward to more collaboration to work on reentry with these individuals. And just so you know, House Bill 2685 was unanimously passed by the House on April 15th. The department welcomes this committee's support of the bill, and I'm here to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Questions?
What Senator question? Close. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kim, could you just tell us what the restrictive language was so that we can watch for that in the future?
I think it's, excuse me, Chair Przanski, Senator Close, the language had to do with our ability to release inmates on work release or other types of programs into community corrections while they still are inmates, while they're still in our custody. So we didn't have the ability to hand them over to another agency. It was an old statute that just was in place for a period of time. And as this new reentry kind of method comes into line, it didn't fit with that.
Okay, so it was a custody problem.
Correct.
Thank you.
All right, and Representative Cameron, I hope that you're that we're successful in gaining more money to actually put in these programs. I think we both know from our communities how, if you have a reentry program, how effective it can be and has been, and hopefully the public safety committee will be able to actually realize some savings to actually put back into the community. But thank you for your time. Any other comments? We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2685. I'm going to go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 2685. Senator Dingfelter?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2685 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Dingfelter moves House Bill 2685 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And let's see.
I'd be happy to carry it if you'd like.
Senator Dingfelter will be the carrier on 2685. We'll close the work session on 2685, and we'll open up our public hearing on House Bill 2571.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2571 comes to you from the Oregon State Bar Family Law Section. Chair, members of the committee, it terminates spousal support on the death of either party unless otherwise expressly provided for in the judgment. Among other things, it allows affiliation proceedings to be brought in the circuit court of the county where either parent or alleged parent of the child resides. As chair, members of the committee, you also have the -1 amendments in front of you, which clarifies that unpaid spousal support does not terminate upon the death of either party. And I believe both the bar and the is in support of that amendment.
All right. Well, we're going to find out. Ryan, are you going to lead off, or is Janet?
I'd be happy to, okay. Senator Przanski. Thank you. My name is I'll start out with Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Thank you for having me here this morning. My name is Ryan Carty. I am a member of the Oregon State Bar. I'm in private practice here in Salem with the firm of Soci & Soci, and my practice is exclusively limited to family law. I also serve as the legislative liaison for the family law section of the State Bar, and I'm the chair of the legislative subcommittee for that section. And I'm here in my official capacity with the bar this morning to urge the passage of House Bill 2571. What this bill does is two completely separate things, but they're both law improvement provisions to statutes that the bar felt were appropriate to make. The first deals with spousal support, and this is what the Dash 1 amendment addresses. In order to qualify as spousal support for taxable purposes, and that means that the payor, the person paying support, gets to write it off of their taxes, and the payee has to claim it as taxable income. But in order to qualify for that under the Internal Revenue Code, one of two things needs to happen. Either the judgment expressly needs to provide that support terminates upon the death of the payee spouse, or, number two, state law needs to provide for that termination. Currently in Oregon, state law is not clear on whether that occurs, and that was brought to the forefront by a Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals opinion in which the court said, we understand that Oregon case law has said that that's what Oregon does, but state statute isn't very clear on that. So the state bar felt that we should be clear and include that when either the payee spouse or the payor spouse dies, the support ought to terminate. The DOJ pointed out that any unpaid support as of the date of the death of a payor ought not to terminate, and the bar agrees with that. So that's where the Dash 1 amendment came from, and we are in agreement on that. And I'll let Ms. Borth of the DOJ discuss that Dash 1 amendment. The second issue dealt with in House Bill 2571 deals with financial restraining orders that are set forth in ORS Chapter 107. As you may be aware, there are a number of financial orders of restraint that automatically go into effect upon the filing and service of a petition for divorce. Those are found in ORS Chapter 107-093. Those provisions automatically apply to any Chapter 109 case dealing with filiation, child support, those types of unmarried parent cases, but only to the extent that those provisions deal with child custody, child support, parenting time, etc. And so there's some ambiguity there, because what the financial restraining order does is it essentially says you can't spend any huge amounts of money, you can't transfer property, you can't change your life insurance beneficiaries, you can't cancel a health insurance policy, those types of things that we don't want anybody going and doing inappropriately when a divorce is filed. And the issue in terms of the 109 case is which of those apply, because theoretically a transfer of property, if I am an unmarried parent and I want to sell my car and I have an ongoing child support case, well then theoretically my financial resources apply to child support, and so I would, as a technical matter, even though I don't think this has ever happened, I would be prohibited from selling my car and buying a new one simply because I have an ongoing child support case. That's not the intent of the statute. That's not how it's applied in practice, and so the bar felt that we ought to specifically provide for a set of financial restraining orders or of statutory restraining orders that apply to ORS 109 cases that make sense in that context. And that's what this bill does. It deals with life insurance and health insurance, things that do directly impact the child that we're talking about. On behalf of the bar, I would urge the passage of House Bill 2571, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Janet Borth. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Oregon Department of Justice, and I'm here today on behalf of the Division of Child Support to ask the committee to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to clarify that spousal support arrears would survive death. And the reason for that actually is that the division will collect spousal support along with child support. And if child support arrears were to survive death and spousal support arrears were to terminate upon death, the division's accounting system just couldn't tease those two apart.
All right. Any questions? Anyone else who wants to testify today on House Bill 2571? Not seeing anyone, we're going to go and close the public hearing. Ryan, you just stay right where you're at, sir. And we're going to go ahead and open the public hearing. Excuse me, a work session. Senator Dingfelter.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2571 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Dingfelder moves House Bill 2571 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Cruz, will you be our carrier on this one?
Could you drop the deaf one?
Oh. Make a motion to reconsider the vote we just took for the purposes of adopting the dash ones. I thought the dash ones were already in.
Thank you.
But there weren't.
Okay.
So is any objection to reconsider?
No.
All right. So.
All right, Mr. Chair, I move the dash ones be adopted into House Bill 2571.
Senator Dingfelder moves the dash ones into House Bill 2571. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2571 as amended with the dash ones to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Dingfelder now moves House Bill 2571 as amended by the dash ones to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Again, any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
I can still carry it.
Great. Thank you very much. We'll close the work session on 2571, and we're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on 2572.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2572 comes from the Oregon State Bar Family Law Section, allows a court to award attorney's fees where one party in domestic relations matter is required to maintain life insurance in his or her life in order to guarantee payment of spousal or child support.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Ryan Cardi. I'm an attorney in private practice here in Salem with the firm of Soci & Soci. My practice is exclusively limited to family law. I am also the legislative liaison for the family law section, and I am the current chair of the family law section's legislative subcommittee. It is my official capacity with the bar that I appear before you today. House Bill 2572 addresses two distinct issues, the first of which, and I'll go in reverse order from my written testimony here, but the first of which makes the provisions of ORS 107, 810 through 830, and those provisions provide the court the authority, this is not a mandatory or an automatic, but simply provide the court with the authority in appropriate cases to award or to mandate that a payor spouse, the person paying either spousal or child support, be required to provide life insurance to cover that obligation. Right now, many of the provisions of ORS Chapter 107 translate directly to ORS Chapter 109 dealing with unmarried parents, but those sets of statutes do not carry forward to Chapter 109. And that means that currently, from a technical standpoint, even though I think courts already do this, in fact, I know they already do this, but from a technical statute standpoint, there's zero statutory authority for the court in an unmarried parent case to require that the obligor spouse provide life insurance. And that's just not equitable that a child of married parents would have some life insurance to cover some child support, but a child of an unmarried a child of an unmarried couple would not have that same opportunity. So the bar felt it appropriate that we make those provisions applicable to ORS Chapter 109 as well. The second component of this bill affords the court the opportunity, if appropriate, to award attorney fees to a party who has to bring an action in court in order to enforce the court's order that the party provide life insurance. As you may know, the only way in a domestic case to receive attorney fees is if there is specific statutory authority to do so. Currently, there is not. So if I'm an obligee and I receive support and the court has said you, obligor, ought to provide life insurance to cover that support, you fail to do so, and now I have to go to court in order to mandate that you follow what the court has said, I can't get attorney fees from you for having to do so. And we didn't feel like that was appropriate. We felt this was an access to justice issue, and we felt that the statute ought to be consistent with other types of contempt and enforcement mechanisms where attorney fees are allowed. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Questions? Senator Dingfelder.
Thank you. Thank you for the excellent overview. Question I had is, you talk about unmarried parents. Would that also apply to domestic partnership?
There's a separate set of statutes dealing with the domestic partnership that would not be addressed at all by what this bill does. And in fact, so if you have a domestic partnership, whether you're parents or not, then you would file a dissolution of domestic partnership in which you can receive many of the same things you would under a typical dissolution, including a financial order of restraint. What this bill does is it only addresses those cases that are filed as either affiliation proceeding to establish parentage, a child support proceeding, custody proceeding, or a child support proceeding. So only in those types of cases, not a domestic partnership proceeding, but only in these child-based cases are we talking about this specific order of restraint.
So, and maybe I didn't make my question clear, a follow-up is, would this apply then if it was the same situation with a domestic partner? And I didn't know if there's a separate set of statutes that would have to be, it would have to be mirrored.
Thank you, and to be appropriate, Chair Przanski, Senator Dinkfelder. The financial order of restraint does apply to a dissolution of domestic partnership. So that's already covered by Oregon statute. It's just this subset of child-related cases only that is not specifically dealt with, and we feel that it's over-covered and ambiguous. Does that answer your question a little better?
Sort of.
Well, the issue is
I think she'll be carrying the bill, so she'll get
more right.
ready for it.
Well, no, I guess I just want to make sure that if it was where we were talking about a custody issue in a domestic partnership, that it would apply the same as when we're talking about a married or unmarried couple.
Right, and I'll break it down like this. So if you think about dissolution cases versus simply child custody cases, in dissolution cases, including domestic partnership cases, we can do things like divide property. In child support custody cases, filiation cases, we don't divide property. So in domestic dissolution cases, including domestic partnerships, including marriages, in those cases, this entire 107.093 framework of financial restraint applies. You can't sell the car. You can't liquidate the bank account. You can't change your retirement beneficiary in a domestic partnership or a marriage proceeding. There's some ambiguity as to whether that would also apply to a child support, filiation, or custody proceeding, and we felt that we should be specific there. So those cases are the only things that this bill would apply to. So the domestic partnership proceeding, absolutely. We're still restricting people from any types of transfers of property in those proceedings, just like a marriage.
Okay, thank you.
Any other follow-up?
I'll do it.
You may.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ryan, can you give us an idea? I'd just like to know what kind of burden, you know, we're adding to people. In your experience, how much a year would this add to their obligation, this insurance policy? I know they vary.
Chair Przanski, Senator Close, thank you. You're 100% correct. That's a difficult question to answer. I think the first thing I can tell you that will hopefully be a benefit is that this is not a mandatory provision. This is discretionary with the court. So what the court's going to do in a child support filiation or a dissolution case in which support is ordered is the court's already going to look at the entire financial obligations that each party has and financial resources. And in those cases, to determine whether it's appropriate, I can tell you that one of the arguments routinely used in court is to look at the death benefit available through Social Security to see if that will cover the child support obligation. In my experience, life insurance is typically ordered in a couple of cases. One, where it's very cheap through employment. Two, where there's an existing policy and these people have already planned their financial resources to provide for life insurance, and the court says, look, you did it when you were married or you did it when you were co-parenting. We ought to continue that now. And the third is when you have these really high dollar figure child support cases where the Social Security death benefit in a typical case where you're paying $400, $500, $600 a month, the Social Security death benefit would cover that. But in these really high income cases where the Social Security death benefit simply won't cover it, then life insurance is appropriate. And what the court's in my opinion, are trying to do is make sure that this child right now who's 5 or 6 or 7 or whatever age has support available in the same amount that that child's receiving now up until that child turns 18. And so what dollar figure do we need to have in life insurance to make that happen? You know, it's sort of a forward-thinking progression that may change over time, but this simply gives the court discretion to give to make that analysis.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You bet.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2572, open a work session on 2572. Senator Dingfelter.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2572, and I just am looking to make sure there's no amendments. Is that correct?
There are not.
Okay. House Bill 2572 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Dingfelter moves House Bill 2572 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Roblin, will you be our carrier on this?
I would be honored.
And we'll close the work session on 2572. And we will open up a public hearing on House Bill 2603A.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2603A comes to you from the House Interim Judiciary Committee. To chair, members of the committee, this requires law enforcement to prove that a machine that they have seized as a gray machine is a gray machine and not an amusement device. Chair, members of the committee, this would treat a machine like this, amusement device or a gray machine, similar to what it would be treated under the forfeiture statute in the sense that the person who owns the property would file a motion in court, then it would be incumbent upon the whomever seized it, the law enforcement agency, to prove, in fact, that it was a gray machine and not an amusement device.
All right, thank you. Roger, I see you're here, and I'm not sure who's with you. Is it Jerry?
Jerry Johnson is with me, and Michael Dantu, unfortunately, is not here, but I'll mention his name in a moment.
Okay, I saw it. He was listed. So, Roger, why don't you start off for us?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin, and I represent the Oregon Amusement and Music Operators Association. You have before you a bill that is two sessions in finding a solution, and I hope we have found one. First, let me give you a history, because I'm been here long enough to be able to give you the complete history of video poker. In 1987, the Oregon legislature passed a bill making video poker a game available to the Oregon State Lottery. I was involved very much in that, and former President of the Senate, John Kitzhaber, was very instrumental on the last day of the 87 session in passing the bill. It then went to the lottery for consideration, which was chaired at the time by former President of the Senate, Debs Potts. Mm. And for a year and a half, 2 years, the commission tried to decide whether to make this a private system for the benefit of the state run by private operators or a public system. And unfortunately, from my client's standpoint, they decided to make it a public system. And in the early 1990s, to make sure the system was able to work without competition, they passed the Gray Game Statute. And a gray game, basically, I would describe as a video poker that was owned by a private operator. They were illegal. There were hundreds, maybe even 1,000 or more in the state of Oregon. And it was made, you'll notice on line 9 of the bill, a Class C felony to possess or own a gray game. The result of the passage of that statute 20-some years ago was that gray games disappeared out of the state of Oregon. My client, the Oregon Amusement and Music Operators Association, provides various games, amusement devices, and so forth to arcades, to bowling alleys, to pizza parlors, to bars and taverns for people to play for amusement only. For 15 years, everything worked fine. And then back in the early 2000s, several Oregon State police officers who worked for the Game Enforcement Division for the lottery started making arrests for possession of an amusement device that had a game on it, and Jerry will describe what those games are like. We contend that there's no way that machine is a gambling device. They claim it is. We've argued for two sessions about what the solution should be. We had an interim study group. Your counsel, Bill Taylor, attended several of those meetings. We came to no agreement. The Oregon State Police, with the lottery, decided that they would allow these games to be illegal at Oregon if each game and each machine can have several hundred games on it. If each game was examined by an independent agency back east, a private consulting firm, which would have been a hugely expensive proposition. The bill was introduced over in the House, and the House committee came up with these amendments, which simply say, if you're going to make an arrest, and a felony is something that none of you have ever experienced, nor I, but it can be terrifying, and I'll give you the example of that. Michael Dantu, who cannot be here, is a manager of a firm located, I believe, in Senator Dingfeld's district out of Northeast Columbia Boulevard. On a Friday afternoon...
Senator Shields.
Senator Shields, okay. On a sunny day like this in a spring a year ago, late in the afternoon, Michael's working in the back of his shop, and in walks one of his employees and says, "Boss, the state police are out in the lobby." And he went out, they arrested him, read his Miranda rights, handcuffed him, and drove him from Northeast Columbia Boulevard near the airport to the Hillsborough Jail. And if you try that on a Friday afternoon at 5 o'clock, it takes quite a while to get there, and it's very uncomfortable. Michael Dantu is an American citizen who immigrated decades ago from Ethiopia. He's a successful businessman, and in no way in the world ever felt he was going to be in danger to be a felon. They arrest him, they take him out there. He spends several hours in the Hillsborough Jail before he can get contact with somebody to get the money to bail him out. By this time, he is almost in, because he's a diabetic shock. He goes from there to the Hillsborough Hospital, emergency ward, to get whatever medication to get him back to normal. 1 week later, the district attorney of Washington County took one look at the case, dismissed the whole thing. And it all started with a machine that was found on the counter of a tavern in Banks, Oregon, that had a game on it called Jugs 21. And the state police officer said, "It's a gambling device." Now, we maintain on a stack of Bibles that, first of all, the gray game statute worked. There are no gray games left in Oregon. We have amusement devices, and we have a couple of state police that are trying to make an amusement device into a gambling device. This bill simply says, if you make that arrest, prove it in court. It's your job, enforcement, police agency, to prove your point in court, not ours to defend ourselves. And I'd like Jerry to describe the machines and his background.
Good morning, Chair Pernansky and Senators. First of all, I appreciate you folks being here. My name is Jerry Johnston. I own Amusement Unlimited in Eugene, Oregon. My address is 745B River Avenue. I am past president of the Oregon Amusement and Music Operators Association, and I also currently serve as the treasurer for our National Trade Association. I've been a volunteer in our industry for almost my entire career. Next year will be my 40th year in business, and I employ 11 people, 7 full-time and 4 part-time, and I'm here today to endorse this amendment. I have not had any machines confiscated. I have had a couple phone calls from police officers in the last few years. I think one was at a truck stop, and he called me up and said, "Well, I think you got a game on here that might be not be legal." And so I said, "Okay, I'll get somebody out there and we'll take that game off." These countertop games, there'll be over 100 games on these things. And they have different categories, strategy, anyway, just different categories. So one game might be in 4 different places. And our membership has tried. We have sent out bulletins about this, and we've tried to police ourselves and say, be careful. And this game, Chug 21, is a very popular game. And I'm told that the reason it's illegal is because it has the number 21 in it. and it counts down to zero. Now, one thing about that, when we had our study group, just to give you an example of how absurd this is, when we had our study group, the lottery presented a fellow from GLI Labs, which is a company out of New Jersey, and they are the authority on gambling, one of the authorities in the United States. They have customers like the Oregon Lottery and casinos in Las Vegas and just various customers like that. And so during this study group, I asked the question, what about Chug 21? And this is a game that has been picked up. Several of our members have had it picked up. And he said, it is legal in the other 49 states. But in Oregon, it's a felony. And I said, are you sure? And they were taking minutes of the meeting, which I tried to get minutes of the meeting to show you folks, and I have not been able to obtain them. But he said, yes, they're illegal in the other 49 states. And the game that was picked up in Banks, Oregon, I believe, was because of Chug 21, as an example. And so our membership, we've had these games picked up, mostly in the Portland market and on the Oregon coast. Most of the police officers, they think this is ridiculous. They think it's a waste of time. I mean, they're in the 21 years, here's the thing, in the 21 years that this statute has been around, there has not been one gambling citation, not one. And you would think that the state police could find, if there's gambling going on, they could find somebody in 21 years to give a citation to. But all they're doing is saying that these games are casino-style games. And if you've ever been to Las Vegas, there are all these different machines down there that have different themes. And I mean, I believe that there's Pac-Man casino games, etc. So it's not, you could easily say, well, what about, we used to have a pinball, it was called World Poker Tour. And we haven't had any of those picked up. But easily, those could have been picked up too, because Poker Tour, I mean, that, but maybe it was too heavy. I don't know. They didn't want to pick it up. But I'm getting a message here to wrap it up.
Better him than me.
I would be happy to answer any questions. And I would just say, closing it up, is that these machines, they're not being used for gambling. They've got lottery machines right there, and these machines are not capable. They have no system to pay out, to accumulate credits, etc. And I would be happy to answer any questions at this time.
All right. Thank you very much, Jerry. Any questions?
Could I ask a comment?
You may.
Thank you. Jerry, just to clarify, you're saying that this Chug 21, it's because it refers to the card game 21? Is that the connection?
I believe so, and a lot of these games, they just, like if a game has three of a kind, well, that's a connection. Or if it, but there are so many of these games that are designed by these companies, literally hundreds, maybe thousands, and I'm sure that it's a bit of a stretch in our opinion.
And just another clarification. So if I go in there and I see this thing, do I pay to play this game? There's a fee, but there's no money placed to gamble.
The games, generally speaking, are 6 credits for a dollar, which would be 33 cents. And it takes 2 credits to play. A game lasts like 3 minutes or 4 minutes. And they're just games. The only thing that you get, if you get the top score, you would get one replay right then. But other than that, there's no, the machine cannot accumulate credits. It cannot pay out credits.
Got it. Thank you.
All right, any other questions or comments? Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on House Bill 2603A? Not seeing, we'll close the public hearing, open our work session on 2603A.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2603A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Dingfelder moves House Bill 2603A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Questions? Objections? So ordered, Chair will carry 2603A. We'll close the work session on 2603A, and we will open a hearing on House Bill 3278.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3278 comes to you from the, at the request of Attorney General Ellen Rosenbaum, and permits either the Oregon Supreme Court or the Oregon Court of Appeals to vacate a judgment order of a juvenile court if all parties leave appeal agree.
All right, thank you. Aaron, you're here. Were you going to start off or Inga?
I'll go ahead. Thanks, Chair Prezonsky, members of the committee. My name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Attorney General in the Department of Justice here in support of House Bill 3278. So right now in the criminal appellate system, if a mistake is made on an order, either it says something it shouldn't say or it doesn't say something it's required to say, and everybody agrees that there's an error. This is what we call a facial error in the order itself. Everyone can agree that that should just go back to the trial court to be corrected. I was surprised to learn that this doesn't exist for the juvenile system. It's that in the juvenile system, there actually needs to be an appeal, and then we, the Department of Justice, have to formally concede error. The Court of Appeals has to formally order it back to the trial court to vacate and modify the judgment, which uses Department of Justice time, judicial time, defense time for absolutely no benefit. So all this bill would do is bring the juvenile system in line with the adult system and create a mechanism by which a facially erroneous order could be corrected without going through all this process. And Ms. Wells is here to help if we get any tricky questions.
Lifeline. And any tricky questions?
Pretty straightforward, I think.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wants to testify today on House Bill 3278? Not seeing, we'll close the public hearing on 3278. Open the work session on 3278.
Chair, I move House Bill 3278 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Dingfelder moves House Bill 3278 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I just would like to add that it's really pleased to see that Aaron has moved on to do such important work, like clean up all these statutes.
Thank you, sir.
Any other comments?
I'm going to leave that one alone.
Me too. All right, with that, any objection to the motion? Not seeing any, so ordered. Senator Cruz, will you carry 3278?
Sure.
And that will conclude the public or work session on 3278. Now, we do have another bill that we're supposed to have a hearing on today, but there's no one signed up. But I am going to go ahead and open up a public hearing for House Bill 2774 and see if there's anyone here that wants to be heard on 2774. Not seeing anyone, we'll close the public hearing on 2774. And with that,
do you want to do a work session on it?
I do not. Do we have any other business that we need to take care of, Pam? All right, then we'll be back here tomorrow at 8:30. Thank you. We're adjourned for the day.
Aaron, I was going to say...